Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Being raised by a white Canadian mom and a Jamaican immigrant dad, when did you start thinking about race?
I started thinking about race probably around grade 6 or grade 7, around the age of 12. And the reason why is because, you know, when I grew up, it was the mid-90s when I really started to come to an understanding of what being a boy meant and what being popular meant and what fitting in meant. And during that time, in the mid-90s, culture didn't necessarily look like how culture looks like today. You know, culture in the early 90s was these sitcoms with the white family, like Home Improvement, and the teeny boppers like Justin Taylor Thomas and a young Leo DiCaprio and Saved by the Bell with Zach and AC Slater. So, you know, and music too, it was, you know, these boy bands like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. And that was kind of what infiltrated youth culture at the time. And I think like all youth, you're trying to emulate what you see from the outside world. And at that time, that type of culture was so dominant. And I kind of wanted to fashion myself like those teeny bopper boys. So I tried to grow out my hair. And when I grew my hair out, it kind of grew like a cloud to the sky. And it didn't matter how much mousse or gel or dippity-doo that my mom went to Shoppers Drug Mart and bought. By like 10:30 in the morning, you know, it dried up in my hair, just expanded from it. And that was the first time I came to the realization that, you know, different identities are kind of demarcated by race. And it was, for me, this notion of understanding that, oh, I don't necessarily belong to this inside culture, this at the time, this white culture, which was synonymous with pop culture at the time. And it led me to understand that, I'm a black boy.
Well, let's talk about that. You're a teacher now, but when you were in school, when you were in this school, what did you notice about black boys like you?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll take you, continue down the journey, right? So very quickly after that time, when I started to get a little bit older and transition into middle school, like where we are right now, the demographic actually shifted. And at the time, you know, I was born and raised in Scarborough, Ontario. And in the early 90s, the demographic was very still predominantly white. But over that decade in the 90s, the demographic in the East End of Toronto started to change drastically, right? It became very diverse in terms of the communities that that started to move in here, you know, a lot of black bodies, a lot of brown bodies, a lot of Asian bodies. And with that also came this transition in culture where, you know, all of a sudden hip hop started to emerge and become a very mainstream popular form of culture. And with that came, you know, the prominence of the NBA and its kind of height with, you know, Michael Jordan and then later on Allen Iverson and Vince Carter. So what I started to identify with was this idea of hip hop culture and, you know, shows like I mentioned, Home Improvement, which were predominant, started to become replaced by these television shows like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Martin. So for me, I started to, again, wanting to belong, fashion myself to this aesthetic and identity that I started to actually have interest in, right? I was interested in sports. I delved into hip hop music and, you know, I really found myself reflected in some of the artists and songs that I heard on the radio or in my Panasonic CD player. So for me, that started a shift in terms of me no longer wanting to grow out and gel my hair, but, you know, maybe grow out and get braids or maybe have a fade with a part in my hair. And hopefully one day, you know, maybe look aesthetically more like the older black men who I aspire to be like.
All right, I want to pick up on that. You write about these perceived successful roles for black boys in being limited to, you know, music and sports, and a journey that you took yourself when you decided to pursue, not baseball, we won't judge you for that, but football. What can you tell us a little bit about that in terms of, you know, that's something that you saw yourself, this is the role that life and society are kind of telling me to go into that direction, and you did go in that direction and ultimately turned differently, but what was that kind of growing up?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a reality in which, you know, young black males have this unarticulated, internalized experience of when they are in places like a school, of almost being subconsciously told how they can be legitimate and ways that they might be an anomaly in. So, for instance, through institutions like education and the media and news and TV shows and movies, we see this notion where black males are either the athlete or they're the entertainer, rapper, artist, comedian, actor, or unfortunately we see them portrayed in movies and in real life when we turn on the news of being criminals. And it's this idea of growing up where I felt as a young black male that these were the only avenues to success as a black adult, black male adult. So for me, I pursued this path towards athletics because not only did I enjoy athletics, but it was almost this idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy where, you know, I won races at recess and I was decently athletic on the when we played volleyball in gym or played floor hockey outside in the wintertime, or, you know, started to play basketball when the Toronto Raptors came to Canada. But it was almost subconscious in the way that my teachers would validate me like that. They would push me and congratulate me for doing well at a track meet, where it wasn't like I was getting C's and D's. I was getting good grades in grade 4, grade 5, middle school and into high school. But when I was getting those good grades, it was almost like I was treated like an anomaly. So I'll give you an example. I remember a few times, actually, early on, in my high school career, maybe grade 9, when I would get a test back and a teacher would ask me questions from the test. And when I got home, I would reflect on that experience and I would ask myself, why did that teacher ask me to reiterate a question that was on the test? And I would think and wonder if she asked anybody else, and she didn't. And then it was like this understanding that, oh, she was testing me to see if I cheated and to see if I actually remembered what the content was on the test. And she didn't say anything. It wasn't this, you know, explicit, oh, I think you're less than, I don't believe that you're academically inclined. But it's these subtle markers of unexpected subtle racism, and I do use the word racism, where it's you know, being pigeonholed and stereotyped. Whereas on the athletic field, on that platform, you know, black boys like me were congratulated and validated, and in the academic space, we're questioned or considered anomalies. So that's just an example of the ways that I think society in general almost whispers the ways in which black males are allowed to exist.
In your book, you take us through 8 essays, sort of journeying through different parts of your life, different times. And in one of them, you focus on sort of the role music, particularly hip-hop, played in forming your identity. You touched on that a little bit, but there's this great, your opening essay about that trip to the music store, having to even explain to your mother that this is what I really want. This is me.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I remember that like it was yesterday, right? And This was a time where hip hop was becoming mainstream, right? And I remember that experience that I write about in the essay on music and on hip hop. My mom took me to Sunrise Records at Cedar Bay Mall in Scarborough right before my 9th birthday. I was going into the 3rd or 4th grade, and this guy was like the biggest, most baddest guy that came out, and his name was Snoop Dogg, and he had this debut album. I'm not gonna tell you what the title is for the sake of the viewers. But let's just say it was explicit in a way that a 9-year-old wouldn't even understand.
Right.
And my mother, when I gave her the tape, you know, she was like, yeah, I don't know if I want to buy you this, you know, and she was mentioning Mariah Carey and Toni Braxton and, you know, all these other people that she thought that I should consider. And I was just telling her, like, no, I need this. Like, I literally need this. And, you know, in the book, there's a through line that exists between my relationship with my mother that I think is important, right? It's the idea of, you know, I'm a Black male. The world sees me as a Black male. And, you know, my mother is a first generation Canadian white woman, right? And her ability to not gatekeep my Blackness, not impede on my experiences in terms of what it was that I wanted to experience, in terms of my identity and how I wanted to belong and fit in and represent myself. That there was a, you know, a prime example that I think was important to share. The story alone of, you know, the idea of how hip hop infiltrates our identity and our ways in which we make meaning of ourselves.
All right. Throughout high school and into college, football was life. You went into the States on a scholarship to a couple of colleges there, but now you work as an educator. And I'm curious if you can walk me through that journey from these classrooms as a student and now as a teacher.
Well, this place to me is it's a safe haven, so to speak.
Well, right there, we got 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
That's you.
Yeah. Looking a little younger.
Well, we want to go even younger. So 98, 99, where are we?
Yeah, we're right. Where are we? We're right here.
Oh, things have changed.
Things have changed a lot, my friend. That is a few chapters ago in my life.
How does it feel, you know, graduating and then also being able to teach at this school?
You know, I used to, when I taught here, at the end of the first week, I would always bring my class. I actually taught in that classroom, and I'd walk my class out here on the Friday at the end of the first week and get them to find me and then kind of tell them that, you know, they could talk to me. I've literally been in their shoes, so whatever they're going through, I've literally went through it because I grew up in this area. But yeah, no, I'm proud to, you know, be a son of Scarborough and gone here and then full circle come back and work in the same community that I grew up in.
How did that even, because that wasn't on your radar?
No, it wasn't at all. If you had told me in the 11th grade at 16 years old that I would end up becoming a teacher and leading a career in education, I would ask you what you had for with your lunch. Yeah, and it for me, I always wanted to have a career in athletics, obviously, preferably playing. But even as a sports agent or something in sports management, again, it aligned with this idea of how Black males are allowed to exist. And I led towards that pathway up until the point where I had an injury that actually forced me to sit and consider what it was that I wanted to do with my life. I had to get surgery on my shoulder. And at that time was the first time in my life that I came to the realization that I wasn't gonna make the NFL and be a millionaire and live this lavish lifestyle. Yeah. And upon that, I asked myself if money wasn't necessarily a priority, what would I do with my days? And the answer when I reflected was, you know, I would love to go back to my old high school and just coach the football team. Still aligned with sports,
right,
but now tethered to education. And when I applied and got into the Faculty of Education, a lot of what we did was reflecting on our educational experiences. And that was the first time that I actually reflected on my experience with education as a Black male. And when I started to reflect, I realized that a lot of my friends, a lot of my family members were impeded by the school system. So that for me started a trajectory to want to get into education and shatter some of the stereotypes. I originally wanted to get into education and become a phys ed teacher and a football coach, but I have a double major in history and English. So I wanted to show up as the teacher who came to an elementary school and taught kids English and taught kids history and look like this in a way to hopefully help the next generation of Black boys understand that you don't have to look and exist a certain way to lead a certain lifestyle.
I would say to that response, the younger you would have said, oh, but you're sounding like Carlton. How do you feel reflecting back on that and, you know, sort of, would you poke fun at yourself and be like, oh.
That is a great question. The younger me would say to me that I sound like Carlton. You know what I would tell the younger me? There's nothing wrong with that because Blackness and Black people don't exist in singularity. And I can be Carlton and also be Will Smith. And just because I sound like Carlton doesn't negate anything from my Blackness. And in fact, mm-hmm. I've worked hard to sound like Carlton. I went to school and earned degrees to sound like Carlton. And I could sound like Carlton or I could sound like Will. And there's days where I look like Carlton or look like Will. And that doesn't negate from anything about my authenticity or my identity. Mm-hmm. Because being Black, just like all other races and identities, exist within a continuum. I think that's a good message to tell young Black people, that it is okay to be authentic to yourself and represent yourself the way that you want. And just because you look a certain way and the outside world may perceive you a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be rigid with those stereotypes that box you in. I think that's part of the purpose on shattering the stereotypes, looking like this, and talking like Carlton. I think that's kind of cool, to be honest.
You talk about in your book these subtle and not so subtle incidences of racism. Do you think about those things when you are in the actual classroom talking to students, and how does that impact your teaching style? Like, you know, I have to be careful in sort of how I work with Black students in my classroom, making sure that they do feel seen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, before I ever decided to get tattoos, the skin that I'm in is already, you know, I wear my politics on my skin. Mm. I wear my identity on my skin. So I think that for me, representation is something that you can't be on the fence about. I think that, you know, the idea of being apolitical in education is a political stance. And when we look at what exists in education over the last going on four decades at this point, there's clearly still empirical data that suggests that there's a gap between Black students, namely Black boys, and everybody else. So it's important to have leaders and teachers and educators that are able to show up in a way where they're practicing what they preach, so to say, and that their identity is on the line and in line with their work, right? I am a strong advocate for equity work inside of education, inside of school. And every time I show up to do the work, I'm literally and figuratively showing up to do the work. I think also when it comes to representation, I believe in two things. The first thing I believe in is transparency. When you put students first and you are transparent about that, that is equity work. And the second thing that I believe in is being authentic, trying your best and being humble, yet confident enough to show up as your authentic self. We should be doing that in society on a regular basis, but it's very important to do that in education. It's important to show up as your authentic self.
I imagine you will agree with me in that it's also representation in the books that we read, in the curriculum that we have. As you know, the Ontario curriculum will be updated. It will be September 2025 when, you know, grade 7, 8, and 10s will see Black history in their curriculum and representation. Do you think that will help?
I do. I think it's a first step. You know, I remember when I was in elementary school, there were staff rooms where teachers still smoked inside of buildings, right? In the staff room, in their, you know, their offices. And they stopped that, and it's changed to the point where if you went to a school, or for any building in that matter, and saw somebody smoking inside, you would immediately have this visceral reaction that that is wrong, right? That's how we shift culture, by these small mandates and implementations that over time make a cultural shift. And when it comes to the curriculum, implementing, in this case, Black history, mandating it in particular grades, that is an important first step. Now, is it going to change everything, you know, as soon as they implement it by the end of that school year? Is it going to eradicate racism? Of course not. But it's a first step to try and attempt to change the culture of education and to prioritize equity and to validate the Black experience, which is important. So I do think it's an important first step.
All right, let's talk family. You're quite raw in sort of the stories that you share. Your cousin who was in Detroit was murdered. You talk about your brother who went to prison for quite a while. Yeah. Did you ever feel, even through reflecting on this book, that, you know, your life was falling into a stereotype?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I never really meditated on that. I never considered that, although I'm trying to eradicate and shatter some of these stereotypes that I see that have prevailed when it comes to Black males, when I do sit and think about my life, there are some stereotypes that exist within my own family that is tethered to the Black stereotype of having family members succumb to violence, having close family members go to prison. But that's part of the story, again, right? It's important to not fabricate and share a story that isn't my story. This is my story, and it's important for me to speak about it, not from the outside looking in as some type of expert on the Black experience, or from the inside looking out as some type of weatherman who's trying to give answers and predict the future. This book is an offering to the continuation of the conversation around what it is that the Black experience is. And for me, I'm placing myself in the dead center and merely just looking around, right? The one thing that I think about this book in terms of, you know, how it relates to some particular tropes is that, you know, the only answer is that you need to come up with your own answer when it comes to what the Black experience is like.
All right, I want to talk about your mom. You lost your mom to cancer, and you talk about a very powerful chapter about losing her, but you also talk about sort of your relationship throughout the book about it. And there's this one point where your mom asks you, she's reviewing your writing. She was a masterful copy editor from what I understand.
Yep.
And she asks you why you only write about being Black, because you are of mixed race, you're half white, half Black. And she was kind of, what was your answer to that?
Yeah, I remember that so vividly. It was, well into university at this point, and essay after essay was, you know, focused on my experience within schools and the experience of, you know, navigating schools as a Black male. And my mother asked me why it is that I'm always writing about being Black. And she said, you know, you're half white too, right? And I answered her and said, yeah, I know that, but the world sees me as Black. They don't see me as this complex concoction of multiple identities. And the conversation that we had was around her sharing that she understood my experience and me sharing with her that it was important for her to know that by me writing about being Black, I wasn't denying her existence in my life. And that message is the message that I'm trying to get through within this book as I highlight my relationship with my mother. Oftentimes we look at race as this, you know, pardon the pun, Black and white dichotomy of, you know, rigid lines. And the conversation about my mother saying, yeah, you're also half white, was her trying to liberate my personhood. And I think that's important for us to keep in mind when we think about race and racial issues, that the goal is to maintain our important cultures and histories, but also to transcend our identities so that we can relate on a person-to-person basis.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.